Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Washington Bureau Chief for Alternet, Adele Stan, who has uncovered the real dark side of the Republican presidential frontrunner Herman Cain, not his payoff to women who claimed he sexually harassed them, but Cain's connection to the Koch brothers' political machine that has employed his campaign manager Mark Block and illegally finances Cain's campaign through Koch-funded tax-exempt front groups. Then we'll discuss the U.S. withdrawal from Iraq with senior research fellow at Yale University, Emmanuel Wallenstein, who considers the December 31st pullout of American troops a U.S. defeat comparable to the loss of the Vietnam War, with the likelihood that the remaining police advisors in the Green Zone will need a lot of protection by security guards who will not have immunity, and that Muqtada al-Sadr will emerge as Iraq's main power broker. Wallenstein argues that we are witnessing the U.S. in a serious decline, a new reality that only fringes on the American left refuse to see. Then finally, with six U.S. senators calling for a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United, we will speak with Lawrence Lessig about his new book, Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It. He argues that corruption is the common enemy of the left and the right in America, and that until the citizenry stands up and cleans house in Washington, our money-driven electoral and campaign system will continue to serve only the 1% at the expense of the remaining 99%. I'm now joined by Adele Stan, who is Alternet's Washington Bureau Chief. She has an article on alternet.org called "The End of Herman Cain, The End of the Herman Cain Campaign Question, It's Not What You Think." Welcome to Background Briefing, Adele Stan.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And this revelations that have come out both from your work and from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel are so much more explosive than sexual harassment charges, which of course have been dominating the headlines for the last couple of days. He seemed to have dodged a bullet, largely because I think at the National Press Club it was a pretty softball questioning of him, but both he and his campaign manager dug a hole by denying what they then had to later retract partially on Fox News.
Right.
There was a brief mention in the introduction by the head of the National Press Club of Cain's connection to the Kochs. But why do you think this is not something that the rest of the press are focusing on?
Well, it doesn't involve sex, for one thing. yes, you know, while Washington is drooling over this sex scandal, you know, the dogged reporters in Milwaukee, especially Dan Bice, who he's done amazing work on this at the Sentinel, the Journal Sentinel, have been really going through, you know, very messy records of statements of profit and loss for this defunct nonprofit, Prosperity USA, that was used by Mark Block, the campaign manager of Herman Cain, to pay for campaign expenses, and that's quite illegal. But why, you know, I do think that, you know, sex is always going to, you know, take precedence, but also I think it's been a real slog to get mainstream media, corporate media, to acknowledge the role of the Koch brothers in the Cain campaign, and to really acknowledge the role of the Kochs, you know, in the immensity of their role in United States politics. You know, some of us who cover the Kochs often are made to feel as if we're some kind of conspiracy theorists
right,
for doing so. And I did consider it quite a victory when Cain's Koch connections was mentioned in the intro at the National Press Club, because that was not what we have come to expect.
Well, if it's not about sex, but it is about money, and quite a lot of money, and Block, his campaign, Mark Block, the campaign manager, he apparently had cut quite a swath through campaign laws in Wisconsin. He had paid a $15,000 fine. He'd been banned for a number of years from participating.
Right.
3 years, right? And
yeah,
then the minute he gets unbanned, he signs on with the Koch brothers to lead up Americans for Prosperity in Wisconsin. And boy, is he successful. He gets two right-wing congressmen, Tea Party congressmen, Sean Duffy and Reid Ribble elected, along with Rob Johnson, who replaced U.S. Senator Russell Feingold, not to mention the notorious governor of Wisconsin.
That's right, and a whole lot of legislators in the Wisconsin legislature, you know, and without them you wouldn't have had that anti-collective bargaining law. And I should, for purposes of full disclosure, say that I do do some blogging for the AFL-CIO blog. But yes, I mean, Block is astonishingly successful, but he does use some underhanded methods. As we saw in the recall elections, the Americans for Prosperity put out those what looked like applications for absentee ballots that told people, you know, the wrong day to deliver their applications. In 2010, he was involved in a voter caging operation, voter caging designed to suppress the student vote and the African-American vote in significant precincts in Milwaukee. The guy just has it coming and going. But here's the thing. It seems that the election law in Wisconsin is a bit better than at the federal level. I mean, he, even though he has egregiously transgressed Federal Election Commission code, I'm told that's a rather toothless agency these days. So, you know, just exactly when this will catch up with him from a legal perspective, I don't know.
But it would seem, though, but for your reporting and the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, the rest of the press and the rest of the country see Mark Block as a somewhat comical and bizarre character smoking a cigarette on a somewhat surreal campaign ad for Herman Cain. None of this stuff is
correct.
This is who he should be famous for.
Right. You're right. You're absolutely right. I mean, you know, I think that what happens in a media narrative often is that something, the media get excited about something really bright and shiny and new. And then, that becomes the story. That mm-hmm. becomes the story. And Cain was just such an unexpected figure, and one who did quite well, that I don't know. But I do think there is this sort of reluctance to really lift the curtain and to look at the role of David Koch and the people he employs and what their backgrounds are. And nobody really about Herman Cain as really, you know, a Koch sponsored candidate. Very few people are. And it's really what he's doing. That's what he's there for. Just to represent David Koch in the primaries.
Again, I'm joined by Adele Stan, who's Alternet's Washington Bureau Chief. She has an article on alternet.org called "The End of the Herman Cain Campaign Question: It's Not What You Think." Now, the money that's been funneled through 501c3s, tax exempt foundations, which are regulated by the IRS, you are only supposed to educate, you're not supposed to advocate.
Right.
And the last thing you can do is finance campaigns, political campaigns. I mean, they railroaded an Episcopalian minister out here in Pasadena for making an anti-war statement in a sermon during the Iraq War. Yes, the IRS went after him. It was a bit of a reach, but mm-hmm. this, what they've been doing, is so flagrant. It's amazing. Hundreds of thousands of dollars have been funneled through this defunct 501c3 Prosperity USA to pay for the woman who sang the song. That's Herman Cain's campaign theme song.
Right.
The guy that wrote it, her husband, he gets paid in a couple of different ways. It's just walk us through this.
Don't forget the private jets. The private jet travel for Herman Cain. He can't fly coach. He flies on
he flies Coke, right?
Yes. To go to Americans for Prosperity events after he had already declared his candidacy, and then to appear at another right-wing event, and it was noted on the profit and loss statement that Bice uncovered that it was at the request of Americans for Prosperity that he was appearing at that event. And he's taking private jets to these events.
So is it possible that the speaking fee that he didn't get, he actually got? What was that money for? It's a bit mysterious.
Yes, well, that is really something, and, you know, it's not quite nailed down. Here's what we do know about it, was that using this Prosperity USA nonprofit, the Congress of Racial Equality, which is actually a right-wing organization, had they were given $100,000. That was raised in loans to Prosperity USA, who then gave it to this Congress of Racial Equality. Then the next thing we know is Herman Cain is the keynote speaker at their awards dinner. And Bice, in his report, said, well, apparently Cain did not receive a speaker's fee for that. But a couple weeks ago, Jane Mayer of The New Yorker had been looking into Cain's speaking fees, noting that they do not appear. There are none listed on his FEC forms. And she found that he has this separate company called New Voice, that his speakers bureau likely pays this separate company whatever he takes in speakers fees. So in other words, you know, the fee would go to his speakers bureau, the speakers bureau would pay his company, and that would not be reflected on his Federal Election Commission statements. So we don't know. We don't know whether or not he got paid for that. He could have very well been paid a fee by CORE, by the Congress of Racial Equality, for that speech, but to his speakers bureau.
So, Adele Stan, there's been some speculation because of the bizarre nature of this campaign, and particularly the commercials that he did, the strange Western that he made, along with the aggressively anti-PC smoking ad featuring Mark Block. And it seems to me this campaign, even though they're the Republican frontrunners, there's only two of them, Herman Cain and Mark Block. It all seems extraordinary. He makes the most absurd, ignorant, and racist comments in these debates, and nobody seems to pull him over for it.
Right.
He has a bizarre, 999 thing that is very catchy, and people have been laughing about it. It would, of course, impoverish Americans even further and enrich the Kochs even further if it were ever adopted. But the speculation is that he's actually, and this is also applies to Michelle Bachmann, that they're really in this race, and I guess you could also apply this to Newt Gingrich. They're in this race to raise their profiles and therefore raise their speaking fees, and that's what it's all about, selling books and having high speaking fees.
Well, I think that in the case of Gingrich and Cain, that is correct. I mean, I think that's probably what Herman Cain saw in it for himself. You know, as Tom Hartman called it, the Herman Cain retirement plan. And possibly a Fox News job and all that comes with that. In terms of Bachmann, you know, I think that she really may have had intentions of seeing herself as running as the number two on the ticket. I really do. I think that she may have been positioning herself, or may still be trying to position herself, for a vice presidential nomination.
So that she's like Sarah Palin light, is that the idea?
Well, I mean, Palin did sort of pave, you know, did cut that path.
Right. But she's completely disappeared, and so to some extent has Michelle Bachmann. So the best laid plans.
Yeah, they're on the wane right now.
But the real question now, Adele Stan, is what's in it for the Kochs? If they're financing this campaign of Herman Cain's, and they seem to be the biggest financiers through these various nonprofit front groups, and of course, using a nonprofit for electioneering is highly illegal, but I don't know what the IRS are doing in this case. What is their motive? It's very mysterious, because this guy is not going to win.
Right.
So are they running him as a spoiler? Is there somebody in that race they want to block?
Well, I don't know that it's necessarily that they want to block somebody, but they want to bend the positions of whomever the nominee is to their side. So what you've seen with Herman Cain, right, in his ridiculous 999 plan, well, what happens next? Rick Perry comes out with a flat tax plan, Mitt Romney will be pushed to have a more flat, you know, tax proposal. What they will do is they will do two things. They'll push the positions of whomever is the nominee more towards the Koch positions. And two, the longer that Kane stays in the race and is able to remain popular, and of course with all of this turmoil, we'll see how it shakes out a few weeks from now. But if he can remain popular and pick up delegates through the primary, those delegates will still be pledged to him until he releases them at the convention. So that gives them sway at the convention as to what's in the platform. I saw them do this with Bob Dole in 96, where Pat Buchanan, you know, had enough delegates to exact a whole lot of concessions from the Dole people, and in fact the writing of the Republican platform was handed over to Phyllis Schlafly and Babe Buchanan, and then Dole had to run on that platform. And so I see that this is more of that kind of a game.
Well, they certainly have enormous resources. Do you think the somewhat extraneous sexual stuff is going to sink him? I mean, it is pretty appalling that that's the focus.
It's hard, you know. And I keep, you know, I'm going back and forth on this and back and forth on this because, I mean, the thing is, if he came out, see, you do have this evangelical base, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who do not take kindly to, you know, to this kind of a thing, unless. The penitent, you know, beats his chest, mea culpa, and asks forgiveness. And then, I mean, you know, redemption is very big in that culture. So, and the other thing is, you can bet that the women who have accused Kane will be accused of being Democrats and of being Jezebels and of, you know, and they will be smeared, you know.
Yeah, but there were sealed deals for that specifically because they sealed these settlements. The women can't speak. That would seem to be deliberate.
Yes, well, we'll see what happens with that because Kane may have actually broken the deal by speaking himself. So there's a whole lot of legal thinking going on right now as to whether or not one of these women will be able to speak.
I'm just curious, though, how you would get out of, how would you expiate in a good Christian self-flagellating way about sexually harassing women, saying, you know, Jimmy Carter once said that he lusted after women in his heart.
Well, because it wouldn't be his fault. It would be the fault of the women.
They were angling for money.
I mean, and he was helpless in their thrall.
That's right. And they were really after his money.
I mean, just look at the Bible. How are women depicted? You know? Jezebel, Eve. I mean, it's always the woman's fault, right? So I do think he could survive the sex scandals if they, you know, depending on how they go. It's possible.
Well, but as long as it goes on, it also distracts people from what you are reporting, Adele Stan, and what the Milwaukee Sentinel Journal are reporting. And that's the story, really.
If the IRS would actually go after this and a prosecutor would take it up, or the IRS, its own prosecutorial, you know, it has its own courts and everything, would take it up, then that would be something.
Well, they, as I say, they went after an Episcopalian out here, a minister. And you know what they say about the Episcopalian? The Jews are God's chosen people and the Episcopalians are God's frozen people. So this poor rector got reamed by the IRS, you know, for saying that something was wrong with the Iraq war.
Oh, my.
It's something of a double standard, I would argue.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I mean, and I'm sure if the IRS were set upon poor little Herman Cain, that, you know, it would be blamed on the president. But we'll see what happens. My gut is that the powers that be are probably going to want to get Cain out of the way pretty soon.
Well, if you're in the White House, you'd probably want him to keep running.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. This is, you know.
And if you're becoming the Cokes, you've got some other agenda. I suspect what you're saying is that it really does make sense, that it's all about moving the agenda in terms of the Republican
platform.
Moving the
needle. It's all about moving the needle. Right. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. It's always a pleasure.
Oh, thanks so much, Ian, for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Adele Stan, who's Alternet's Washington Bureau Chief. She has an article on alternet.org called "The End of the Herman Cain Campaign Question, It's Not What You Think." We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about how the U.S. lost Iraq just like Vietnam.
You heard it on the radio, tape it, play it in your stereo, your crew will go ape it. Raw lyrics, he smells them like a hunch, the same intuition that tells him spike the punch. Curses, he's truly ferocious, with enough rhymes to spread throughout the boundless universes. Let the beat blast, she told him wear the mask, he said you better scoop ass. It's made of fine chrome alloy, find him on the grind, he's the rhinestone cowboy.
It's time to get away. It's time to get away from you. It's time to get away. It's time to get away from you. You brought a lot of money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Emmanuel Wallerstein, who's a senior research scholar at Yale University. He's the former president of the International Sociological Association and chair of the International Gulbenkian Commission on the Restructuring of the Social Sciences. He writes in three domains of world system analysis: the historical developments of the modern world system, the contemporary crisis of the capitalist world economy, and the structures of knowledge. He's the author of The Decline of American Power, The U.S. in a Chaotic World. And you've also written recently, Emmanuel Wallerstein, about the U.S. withdrawal from Iraq, basically comparing it to the U.S. defeat in Vietnam.
Right.
What's been the response?
Well, so far fairly good, but, so far people have agreed with me. I get some very complimentary things, but I'm sure there are people who disagree with me. What can I say? It's not a popular theme, U.S. defeat, neither on the right, center, or on the left, which curiously there are some people on the left who can't accept that the U.S. ever gets defeated. But the fact is, people in Iraq know it, and people in the U.S. government really know it. They just don't say it. They can't say it. In fact, there was a story in the New York Times today that more or less indicated that the U.S. government really is aware of the degree to which they have been defeated in Iraq.
Well, Emmanuel Wallerstein, back at the time of the drumbeat for war, when there was euphoria throughout the United States and particularly in the press about Operation Iraqi Freedom. It was originally, the acronym was going to be Operation Iraqi Liberation.
Right.
And somebody realized that that acronym spelled oil.
Okay, I didn't know that story, but that's a very good one. But look, euphoria, first of all, everybody in the U.S. was presented with the proposition that this would be a slam dunk affair, very quick, get it over with, and everybody will greet us with joy in Iraq, and it won't cost anything because it's going to be done on the cheap, in a sense. That's what Rumsfeld promised. We'd do it from high planes, and very few lives would be lost. And, of course, there was euphoria. It warms the cockles of your heart to be a powerful nation, and people jump into the fray. But as soon as they realized which didn't take really more than a year, that this was a quagmire, which got worse and worse and worse as the years went by. The war became less and less popular in the United States because there was a real price to pay and very little benefit coming from it. The backlash has been enormous. So there you are.
I was going to say, though, that perhaps I'm tooting my own horn, but I was probably one of the only people in the American press saying at before the Iraq War began that it would be a quick victory followed by a slow defeat.
You were absolutely right.
I wanted to explain.
There you are.
But the reason I said that wasn't that I'm any kind of genius, that I spoke with former CIA people like Bob Baer and Graham Fuller, who both of whom speak Arabic and know Iraq, and Yusuf Ibrahim, the former New York Times Middle East correspondent, who obviously speaks Arabic too.
Right.
They knew the area, and Brent Scowcroft, the former National Security Advisor under Bush Sr., also warned that this would be a strategic disaster.
He tried very hard. In fact, Bush Sr. tried very hard. But the point is, the neocons took over for a short while. They thought they were going to show the entire world that the only way to handle this was what I call macho militarism. And, of course, it backfired incredibly. It did just the opposite of everything they expected. They intimidated nobody. They strengthened every force that they didn't want to strengthen. And they turned what had been a slow U.S. decline over 30 years into what I call a precipitate decline. So there it was. The U.S. was sort of dragging its feet and doing medium well, given the fact that it was declining. And these neocons come along and say, this isn't good enough. We've got to really go whole hog. And, of course, that absolutely backfired. Bingo, we went over the cliff, and like Humpty Dumpty, the pieces will never be put together again. It's definitive.
Again, I'm speaking with Emmanuel Wallenstein, senior research scholar at Yale University and the former president of the International Sociological Association. He's the author of The Decline of American Power, The U.S. in a Chaotic World. Of course, the neocons are coming back. They're advising Mitt Romney. They've never been held to account, not to mention Cheney, Bush, Rumsfeld, or Rice, for that matter. And she's got a book out now telling us what a brilliant, thoughtful man George W. Bush was, and how he read a lot, she's supposed to be an intelligent person. Why didn't she listen to Brent Scowcroft? He, after all, brought her into the National Security Council.
Well, to be fair to her, she was halfway between Brent Scowcroft the last 2 years of Bush's presidency, they were pulling back from this stuff. You only have to read Cheney to know how angry he is about what happened in the last 2 years. And that was her belated realization that this was a dead end, along with the Secretary of Defense, who was Crew Gates, who was crucial in that pullback. The real problem came after that. The real problem came. Obama thought that he could go back to the Clinton policies and get us back to where we were in the days of Bill Clinton, which was certainly a little better than where we are now. But that was a totally unrealistic objective, and results in what's happening right now, which is the total pullout. We were pushed out, and that has not been lost on anybody in the Middle East. Everybody is aware of it. Friend or foe, they're all aware of the fact that the U.S. was pushed out.
Well, it was because, wasn't it, the Iraqis insisted on sticking to the agreement that George W. Bush had made to withdraw by the 31st of December 2011.
Yes, that was the best that George Bush could get at that time, you see, and it was always the hope that they could extend it and so forth, but it was an unrealistic hope because of the internal the depth of Iraqi nationalism. That's what people don't seem to believe that other people are nationalists. And Iraqis are nationalists. They believe in their own country. They want it to be autonomous. They want it to be not occupied by the United States or by Iran or by anybody else. The people inside Iraq who've been pushing this line have won out.
It's pretty extraordinary, right? Isn't it extraordinary, Emmanuel Wallerstein, that Americans don't understand that? They fought a revolutionary war against the British occupiers, and they were co-religionists and spoke the same language, let alone being a foreign invader occupying your land.
Look, the U.S., you know, after the Second World War was on top of the world, and people got used to being on top of the world. They liked being on top of the world. And it's very hard to accept the fact that you're no longer on top of the world, that you're, you know, that everybody isn't sitting around just admiring you and thinking you're the greatest and that you are the chosen nation and so forth. It takes a long while to sort of, accept the reality of just being the United States is not exactly a weak, poverty-stricken country. It's simply no longer able to get its way everywhere at every moment. It's just one major power among a whole series of major powers in the world, and not the most powerful of them, really.
So you said earlier, Emmanuel Wallerstein, that the American left are having a hard time recognizing...
Some parts of it. There are parts of the American left who are so invested in fighting American imperialism and so forth and so on that they can't really believe that the U.S. doesn't get its way all the time. So they invent all sorts of magical explanations of how, despite the fact that it seems to be losing, it's really winning. And that's very unrealistic and not very helpful in terms of trying to change things in a healthy direction.
So all of those theories that we went in there for the oil and the bases
that.
And all that stuff.
For one thing, Saddam Hussein was perfectly willing to sell oil to the United States or to anybody else. It isn't as though we were holding out on the oil. It was a crazy idea from the beginning. All these people are ready to sell the oil. You don't have to go in to occupy them to get the oil as though the oil were being denied. We were denying ourselves the oil because we didn't want to buy it from Saddam Hussein. I mean, you know, come on. It never gelled as a real explanation. No, the real explanation of why we went in was the theory that if we intimidated everybody and showed we were macho militarists and unilateralists and so forth by preference, then everybody else would sort of recognize that the U.S. ought to run the world, is running the world, and so forth. That's why we went in, not for the oil. The oil, of course, would follow from that because, of course, if we ran the world, we'd get whatever oil we needed. But we were getting whatever oil we needed, you know. We were never suffering from an oil shortage in the United States.
So ironically, of course, Emmanuel Wallerstein, after the shock and awe and the quick victory, the Iranian regime, through the Swiss, approached the White House and basically said, listen, we want to talk to you guys. They were afraid that they might be next, and we'll put everything on the table, including our nuclear program. And Vice President Cheney, who apparently controlled the flow of information into the White House, basically gave them the back of the hand and said, we don't talk to evil. So, curiously enough, given that if there's a winner here in the Iraq war, it would be Iran.
Up to a point.
Yeah.
I mean, Iran certainly hasn't lost as a result, but people underestimate the depth of strain between Iraqi Shiites and Iranian Shiites. And the Iraqi Shiites have no intention of letting Iran run Iraq, not to speak of the Iraqi non-Shiites. They are Arabs. don't forget that the Iraqi Shiites believe that they are the cultural center of the Shiite world, that and not Iran. Iran is a second best in terms of Shiite theology and so forth. They really see themselves as the center, and they're not about to yield to the primacy of the Ayatollahs sitting in Qom in Iran. They had to go along for a while because they were being harassed by Saddam Hussein, so they, a friend in need and so forth. But basically, the Iraqi Shiites want to run, they want to be the center of the Shiite world, and they probably will be again. And the Iraqi Shiites are also Iraqis and are Iraqi nationalists, not merely Iraqi Shiites. They don't want to just to run a Shiite segment of Iraq. They would like to be a major force within all of Iraq, and that for that they have to make certain kinds of compromises with the Sunni and the Kurds, and they will. Running a country is a complicated thing, and you have to pull various groups together. But Iraqi nationalism is the big victor. Iran hasn't lost, but is not a victor in the sense of running the show inside Iraq. That's simply wrong.
Again, I'm speaking with Emmanuel Wallenstein, who is a senior research scholar at Yale University, the former president of the International Sociological Association, and the author of The Decline of American Power, the U.S. U.S. in a Chaotic World. So you also say in your article, the title of which is Youth Withdrawal and Defeat in Iraq, that you think that in the next Iraqi election, the likely winner will be Muqtada al-Sadr.
Well, he won't win a majority. What I'm saying is he now incarnates Iraqi nationalism, and I think he'll be able to put together a coalition after the next election, such that he's the most likely person to be prime minister. It may not. It's very hard to predict, as you know, the details of outcome of an election which has many parties and many groups and so forth in a parliamentary system. But it seems to me he's the most likely candidate for being prime minister of Iraq, and the U.S. won't be happy, and Iran won't be happy. But there you are. You're going to live with the realities of the world.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Emmanuel Wallenstein, again, senior research scholar at Yale University. He's a former president of the International Sociological Association and chair of the International Gulbenkian Commission on Restructuring the Social Sciences. He's the author of The Decline of American Power, The U.S. in a Chaotic World. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be joined by Lawrence Lessig, the author of a new book, Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It.
The newborn in the hammock rocks below a bolted sky that unlocks for the departing of the flux from the shadow of an empire. God loves a trier, an articulate liar. The auctioneer makes it clear and boom.
The plan keeps coming back again. And the plan means nothing's been the same. But the plan won't accomplish anything. If it's not him, wrong, then dead.
Joining us now is Lawrence Lessig, the director of the Edmund J. Safra Foundation Center for Ethics at Harvard University and professor of law at Harvard Law School. Lawrence Lessig clerked for Judge Richard Posner of the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals and Justice Antonin Scalia of the United States Supreme Court. His new book is Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lawrence Lessig.
Great to be here.
And the book really points out that the corruption is the common enemy of both the left and the right, And we've seen manifestations of protests starting in Wall Street that have spread across the country and around the world. Do you think there's a chance that the Occupy Wall Street movement and, for example, the Tea Party on the right could find a common cause?
Well, I think that the actual members of the Tea Party, the kind of grassroots movement that began in about February of 2009, is filled with lots of people who look at the existing system and think that it's corrupt. And it's corrupted by the influence of money inside of Washington, and it's corrupted against their issues or interests as much as it's corrupted against issues on the left. And so what I think it is an extremely important moment and opportunity for the people in both of these movements to find a way to talk to each other. And I mean that distinction quite carefully, because the movements themselves, the Tea Party movement and the Occupy Wall Street movement, the leaders in each of these movements, don't have much of an interest for the people in these movements to actually work together. They have a very important, valid, and rewarding interest in keeping the movements clear and separate and angry at the other side. But I do think that we could make enormous progress in the United States with the fundamental problem of our democracy if both sides would recognize that there was common ground here and they should step on it and try to solve the problem of Americans' corruption.
So how much is this, though, a reflection of the general abdication of our responsibilities in a democracy, the fundamental one being to vote? I mean, we barely get 60% in the best of times voting. And the political professionals and the fundraisers and the pollsters have created a huge business. It's a multi-billion-dollar business. I believe 2012 will set all kinds of records in terms of the billions spent. And the reductio absurdum of all of this polling and focus groups are that, you know, they'll get it down to the point where you won't have to have an election if fewer and fewer people vote. So it's a paradox, it seems to me, that the professionals want fewer and fewer people to vote than those that they can identify. But this plays against the notion of a franchise of people exercising their democratic rights. So what about the biggest voting bloc in this country, the ones that don't vote?
Yeah. So, it might be that it makes sense for them not to vote given the way the system is. Why would you waste your time if money is buying results? You've got a job, you've got maybe two jobs, you've got kids, you've got hobbies, you've got friends, you've things you've got to read, certainly books you got to buy, my book, and read. So you got a lot of things to do out there, and in a world where democracy isn't actually delivering what it was said supposed to be delivering, I kind of get it when people say, I'm not going to waste my time on that. Now, what I think we need to do is produce a democracy where when someone says that, you're able to say back to them, it's not a waste of time. It's exactly what the democratic process is supposed to be. You're supposed to go out and vote, and when you vote, then the people's will gets reflected, and then the government does what the people want. But when this person can say back to you, the government doesn't do what the people want. The government does increasingly what funders want, and the funders are not the people, then I think somebody has a good defense for not engaging. So I want to get to a place where I have a good argument against someone who is trying to justify their not participating in the process. And that good argument only will begin when that person can honestly say, or when we can say to that person honestly, that in fact the system is reflecting the will of the people and not the will of the funders.
Well, I must say, Lawrence Lessig, that is exactly what I heard when I was down at Occupy Los Angeles, and we spoke recently when you were in Zuccotti Park in New York, Occupy Wall Street. That was a pretty common refrain, that this movement is not beholden to any political party, even though obviously the Democratic Party would like to capture it.
Yeah, and you know, if you go to Tea Party events, you'll hear exactly the same refrain the other way around, that they're not beholden to any party, not even the Republican Party. Co-founder of Tea Party Patriots, Mark Meckler at Harvard, a month ago gave an extraordinary speech where, you know, he started by saying he hates the Republicans. But obviously the Republicans have benefited most from the Tea Party's movement because many of the people in the Tea Party are conservatives, and where else are they going to go? So I think that, you know, this what's significant is we've got a populist movement happening in America, a movement on the left and the right who are outside the Beltway, outside ordinary politics, who are tired of ordinary politics because, in some sense, they feel betrayed by it. So, 3 years ago, in 2008, all the action was inside the ordinary presidential election process. Everybody went out to try to register their support either for McCain or for Obama and thought that, in some sense, that victory was going to determine the direction of the country. And then it turned out it didn't determine that much because the same interests that are able to block reform and had blocked reform before continued to block reform even under a supermajority Congress with a president who at the time he was elected could have walked on water. So I think what we've got is, you know, a moment where America is finally waking up to the fact that this democracy needs a fundamental reboot. And the reboot here is not to throw out our Constitution, but it's to reform a critical part, a hole, a gap in the Constitution that the framers never could have expected, because they certainly never expected that people would be spending all of their life raising money to get into Congress.
So, again, I'm speaking with Lawrence Lessig, the director of the Edmund J. Safra Foundation, Foundation Center for Ethics at Harvard University. He's also a professor of law at Harvard Law School and the author of Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It. Obviously, at this point, Lawrence Lessig, we are heading actually, I think, in an even worse direction, in the sense that that the Super Congress, as many warned at the time, would become a magnet for money, that the lobbyists would flock to the members of the Super Congress, Super Committee, I should say, like moths to a flame, and apparently that's already happening. Buck McKeon, the House chair of Armed Services, the defense industry is throwing money at him and the others on the committees. And it does seem that we are actually heading in the wrong, if anything, regressing.
Yeah. I mean, it was interesting when the super committee was first announced, there was a lot of attention to the question of what would the behavior of the super committee be with respect to fundraising. You know, the initial reaction of some of them was to boast of their extraordinary power and to use that boast as a way to raise more money. And then people came forward and said, hey, there's something grotesque about this, and you should not be in the business of leveraging your enormous power into even bigger power to raise money. And so people like John Kerry from Massachusetts promised not to engage in any fundraising while a member of the super committee, but then immediately was involved in a party fundraising event, which he said was not his own fundraising, but just party fundraising. And to most Americans, that seems like a legal difference without a difference. So I think that, what we've seen is, in fact, after the press paid attention to this issue for 5 minutes, the ordinary culture returns, and people inside the super committee are more than happy to take advantage of their power by leveraging that power into fundraising capacity. And, you know, one of the points I make in my book is that this norm, this acceptance of leveraging your power over the people you regulate to raise money, is not a norm that's been around Congress forever. I tell the story of John Stennis, who himself, was not a choir boy. He was a senator who was in charge of the Armed Services Committee, came from Mississippi in the early 1980s. And Stennis was asked by a colleague in the early 1980s to hold a fundraiser for defense contractors. And he said, I hold life and death over these companies. I don't think it would be appropriate for me to raise money from them. So that kind of ethic, which would just be unrecognizable today in Washington. And I think it just is a kind of measure of how far we've come from a world where people understood there were limits. There was some concept of shame, but there's no concept of shame in the system right now.
Well, indeed, Lawrence Lessig, another example would be Senator William Proxmire, who was regularly re-elected to the United States Senate on a strict campaign budget of $500.
Yeah.
And it's amazing. And Teddy Kennedy, towards the, shortly before his death, was in an NPR interview, was asked about what has changed most about the Congress, given that he had a pretty long tenure, about 30 years, I think, even more. And he said that it's money. He said, we used to actually work. We used to actually do 5 days a week. And now we only start on Tuesday or Wednesday and maybe do Thursday. But then certainly by Friday, we're out of there and we're not back till, off on the weekend raising funds. So that is the system. So one of the things you point out in your book, The Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It, Lawrence Lessig, is that only a few people in this country understand that the kind of conversation we're having, and that the revolution won't happen until the rest of the country get it. They may have a kind of a sense of it, so that's the challenge, right?
I think that, it requires a kind of self-discipline in the public. And the discipline is, as I was describing before, recognizing that we got to fix this problem before we can fix any other problem. So I like to liken this to the problem of, for example, an alcoholic. So our Uncle Sam is a drunk, and he's obsessed with feeding his addiction, which is campaign funding. And like an alcoholic, he faces a lot of problems. So we could say, like an alcoholic, an alcoholic might be losing his liver and his wife and his job. And those are certainly the most important issues that there are for a person. But what we all understand is he's not going to solve any of those problems until he solves his alcoholism first. So it's not that the alcoholism is the most important problem. It's not. It's just the first problem. And that's the same thing here. We've got all sorts of problems, and depending on your politics, you can tell me which is the most important. I put, global warming as way up there, but other people might just say the size of government or the complexity of taxes or whatever. But my point is, we have to be disciplined enough to say, okay, those are the important problems, but we don't have the capacity to solve those problems now. And what we need to do is to get that capacity, and we get that capacity by building a government we can actually trust, because we don't trust this government. 75% of us think that money buys results in Congress, so 9% of us have confidence in this institution. And unless the institution can fix itself, or maybe we need an intervention here to take the bottle out of Uncle Sam's hand and tell Uncle Sam to get back to doing his job, we're not going to begin to restore that confidence in our government, which is essential for government to work.
Well, I've come from Australia, where they have a law that you essentially get a fine if you don't vote, and they have a pretty high turnout. And the provision in it is that, apropos what we were talking about earlier, about one of the reasons why people don't vote is that, for very good reasons, they think the system doesn't represent them. So there's a thing called the donkey vote, where you can vote for anybody, or even a protest, none of the above. Would that be a way to kind of focus in on the discontent? In other words, the abdication just means that the bad guys win hands down because the good guys abdicate.
I kind of think, there's a lot of suggestions out there about how to change the system. And I kind of feel like we've got one shot. And with that one shot, we've got to create the environment where other reform can happen. I'm looking for reforms that actually plausibly get us to a point where people want to participate in their democracy again. So I understand that forcing people to vote and forcing them to, giving them a chance to say a donkey vote gets to the place where they can be angry about the fact that they are forced to vote and they can all express their donkey vote. But after that, we're still left with people who don't have faith in the system, because still money is driving how the candidates behave in order to get the votes that there are that are not going to be donkey votes. So I think, we need to think through, two steps down the road, what is it that will actually make it possible for people to say, you should trust the system, you should participate and trust the system. And the only way, I think, given the cynicism that exists right now, is to begin to fund the system in a way that doesn't lead people down that cynical path.
So what is the one shot then? We had a system where I think the last two presidents that ran on federal money were the competition between Reagan and Jimmy Carter, weren't they? Would you build on that? Is that what you're suggesting?
Well, no. I think that one big problem we've had for the last 30 years is we've obsessed about the president. And I don't doubt that the president's important, but it's not really the president, in my view, that's the problem, whether Democrat or Republican. The real problem is Congress. So we need a system for Congress. So the question is, what's the system for Congress that gives us a reason to trust Congress? Now, the presidential funding system is a public funding system, but I don't like the architecture of it because what it does is it basically has a government bureaucrat who says how much money each candidate gets. And that, I think, leads to lots of mistrust and lots of skepticism about the process. So the proposal I advance in my book is, let's have a system where first we recognize every single voter contributes at least $50 to the federal treasury. So we've contributed our $50, and now what the federal treasury does is says, we're going to rebate the first $50 of taxes that you've paid, you know, whether it's income taxes or payroll taxes or Social Security taxes or cigarette taxes, whatever. We're going to rebate that first $50 in the form of a democracy voucher. And that democracy voucher you can then use to support any candidate for Congress who agrees he or she will only fund the campaign with democracy vouchers or with contributions from citizens maxed out at $100. So the source of funding for the campaigns is only democracy vouchers plus little small contributions, $100 contributions. Now, if you had a Congress where 50% of the Congress or 75% of the Congress funded their campaigns in that way, then whatever reason Congress had for doing whatever stupid thing Congress did, you couldn't believe it was because of the money. And that's the essential change we've got to find a way to engineer into the system.
But just in closing, Lawrence Lessig, what's happening now, and I remember talking with Senator Tim Worth when he quit the Senate in disgust, he said that, you know, all we do is spend all our time raising funds, which we then turn over to the media oligopolies, because they need the media to get their campaigns out. We can see that. Buddy Romer's running, and he's invisible because he's setting limits and he's doing the right thing. So how do you deal with the media side of the problem?
Yeah, I think the critical first step is to create an institution that's capable of thinking about it in an independent way. So you're right, media is expensive. And lots of other countries force their media to be free for political campaigns. We can't do that without amending the Constitution. So I think the critical first step has got to be to make it so we can have a Congress that can decide these issues without fearing the special interest money, including, dramatically, money for media. And that would happen by an alternative system for funding elections.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us and for your book, Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It. Lawrence Lessig, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbons. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
Time.